earth, to the netherworld, she descended. Inanna abandoned heaven, abandoned earth, to the netherworld she descended. Abandoned lordship, abandoned ladyship, to the netherworld she descended.
She adorned herself with her queenly robes and jewels. 7 divine decrees she fastened at her belt. She was ready to enter the land of no return, the netherworld of death and darkness, governed by her enemy and sister goddess, Ereshkigal. In fear, lest her sister should put her to death, Inanna instructed Ninshubur, her messenger, to go to heaven and set up a hue and cry for her in the assembly hall of the gods, if after 3 days she should have failed to return. Inanna descended. She approached the temple made of lapis lazuli, and at the gate was met by the chief gatekeeper, who demanded to know who she was and why she had come. "I am the Queen of Heaven, the place where the sun rises," she replied. "If thou art the Queen of Heaven," he said, "the place where the sun rises, why, pray, hast thou come to the land of no return? On the road whose traveler returns not, how has thy heart led thee?" Inanna declared that she had come to attend the funeral rites of her sister's husband, the Lord Gugulana, whereupon Neti, the gatekeeper, bid her stay until he should report to Ereshkigal. Neti was instructed to open to the Queen of Heaven the 7 gates, but to abide by the custom and remove at each portal a part of her clothing.
To the pure Inanna he says, "Come, Inanna, enter." Upon her entering the first gate, the shugura, the crown of the plane of her head, was removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rights of the netherworld." Upon her entering the second gate, the rod of lapis lazuli was removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rights of the netherworld." Upon her entering the third gate, the small lapis lazuli stones of her neck were removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rights of the netherworld." Upon her entering the fourth gate, the sparkling stones of her breast were removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rights of the netherworld." Upon her entering the fifth gate, the gold ring of her hand was removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rights of the netherworld." Upon her entering the sixth gate, the breastplate of her breast was removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rights of the netherworld." Upon her entering the seventh gate, all the garments of ladyship of her body were removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rights of the netherworld."
Naked, she was brought before the throne. She bowed low. The 7 judges of the netherworld, the Anunnaki, sat before the throne of Ereshkigal, and they fastened their eyes upon Inanna, the eyes of death.
At their word, the word which tortures the spirit, the sick woman was turned into a corpse. The corpse was hung from a stake.
Inanna and Ereshkigal, the 2 sisters, light and dark respectively, together represent, according to the antique manner of symbolization, the one goddess in 2 aspects, and their confrontation epitomizes the whole sense of the difficult road of trials. The hero, whether god or goddess, man or woman, the figure in a myth or the dreamer of a dream, discovers and assimilates his opposite, his own unsuspected self, either by swallowing it or by being swallowed. One by one, the resistances are broken. He must put aside his pride, his virtue, beauty, and life, and bow or submit to the absolutely intolerable. Then he finds that he and his opposite are not of differing species, but one flesh. Or, as James Joyce has phrased it, equals of opposites evolved by a one same power of nature or of spirit, as the sole condition and means of its him and her manifestation, and polarized for reunion by the symphysis of their antipathies. The ordeal is a deepening of the problem of the first threshold, and the question is still in balance. Can the ego put itself to death? For many-headed is this surrounding hydra. One head cut off, two more appear, unless the right caustic is applied to the mutilated stump. The original departure into the land of trials represented only the beginning of the long and really perilous path of initiatory conquests and moments of illumination. Dragons have now to be slain, and surprising barriers passed, again, again, and again. Meanwhile, there will be a multitude of preliminary victories, unretainable ecstasies, and momentary glimpses of the wonderful land. 2. The Meeting with the Goddess. The ultimate adventure, when all the barriers and ogres have been overcome, is commonly represented as a mystical marriage of the triumphant hero soul with the queen goddess of the world. This is the crisis at the nadir, at the zenith, or at the uttermost edge of the earth, at the central point of the cosmos, in the tabernacle of the temple, or within the darkness of the deepest chamber of the heart. In the west of Ireland, they still tell the tale of the Prince of the Lonesome Isle and the Lady of Tubber Tin Tai. Hoping to heal the Queen of Erin, the heroic youth had undertaken to go for 3 bottles of the water of Tubber Tin Tai, the flaming fairy well. Following the advice of a supernatural aunt whom he encountered on the way, and riding a wonderful, dirty, lean little shaggy horse that she gave to him, he crossed a river of fire and escaped the touch of a grove of poison trees. The horse, with the speed of the wind, shot past the end of the castle of Tubber Tin Tai. The prince sprang from its back through an open window and came down inside, safe and sound.
The whole place, enormous in extent, was filled with sleeping giants and monsters of sea and land, great whales, long slippery eels, bears, and beasts of every form and kind. The prince passed through them and over them till he came to a great stairway. At the head of the stairway he went into a chamber where he found the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, stretched on a couch asleep. "I'll have nothing to say to you," thought he, and went on to the next. And so he looked into 12 chambers. In each was a woman more beautiful than the one before. But when he reached the 13th chamber and opened the door, the flash of gold took the sight from his eyes. He stood a while till the sight came back, and then entered. In the great bright chamber was a golden couch resting on wheels of gold. The wheels turned continually. The couch went round and round, never stopping night or day. On the couch lay the Queen of Tubber Tin Tai, and if her 12 maidens were beautiful, they would not be beautiful if seen near her. At the foot of the couch was Tubber Tin Tai itself, the Well of Fire. There was a golden cover upon the well, and it went around continually with the couch of the queen.
"Upon my word," said the prince, "I'll rest here a while."
And he went up on the couch and never left it for 6 days and nights.
The Lady of the House of Sleep is a familiar figure in fairy tale and myth. We have already spoken of her under the forms of Brunhild and Little Briar Rose. She is the paragon of all paragons of beauty, the reply to all desire, the bliss-bestowing goal of every hero's earthly and unearthly quest. She is mother, sister, mistress, bride. Whatever in the world has lured, whatever has seemed to promise joy, has been premonitory of her existence, in the deep of sleep, if not in the cities and forests of the world. For she is the incarnation of the promise of perfection, the soul's assurance that, at the conclusion of its exile in a world of organized inadequacies, the bliss that once was known will be known again. The comforting, the nourishing, the good mother, young and beautiful, who was known to us and even tasted in the remotest past. Time sealed her away, yet she is dwelling still, like one who sleeps in timelessness at the bottom of the timeless sea. The remembered image is not only benign, however, for the bad mother too, one, the absent, unattainable mother, against whom aggressive fantasies are directed, and from whom a counter-aggression is feared. Two, the hampering, forbidding, punishing mother. Three, the mother who would hold to herself the growing child trying to push away. And finally, four, the desired but forbidden mother, Oedipus complex, whose presence is a lure to dangerous desire, castration complex, persists in the hidden land of the adult's infant recollection, and is sometimes even the greater force. She is at the root of such unattainable great goddess figures as that of the chaste and terrible Diana, whose absolute ruin of the young sportsman Actaeon illustrates what a blast of fear is contained in such symbols of the mind's and body's blocked desire. Actaeon chanced to see the dangerous goddess at noon. That fateful moment, when the sun breaks in its youthful, strong ascent, balances, and begins the mighty plunge to death. He had left his companions to rest, together with his blooded dogs, after a morning of running game, and without conscious purpose had gone wandering, straying from his familiar hunting groves and fields, exploring through the neighboring woods. He discovered a vale, thick grown with cypresses and pine. He penetrated curiously into its fastness. There was a grotto within it, watered by a gentle, purling spring, and with a stream that widened to a grassy pool. This shaded nook was the resort of Diana, and at that moment she was bathing among her nymphs, absolutely naked. She had put aside her hunting spear, her quiver, her unstrung bow, as well as her sandals and her robe. And one of the nude nymphs had bound up her tresses into a knot. Some of the others were pouring water from capacious urns. When the young, roving male broke into the pleasant haunt, a shriek of female terror went up, and all the bodies crowded about their mistress, trying to hide her from the profane eye. But she stood above them, head and shoulders. The youth had seen and was continuing to see. She glanced for her bow, but it was out of reach. So she quickly took up what was at hand, namely water, and flung it into Actaeon's face. "Now you are free to tell, if you can," she cried at him angrily, "that you have seen the goddess nude." Antlers sprouted on his head. His neck grew great and long, his ear tips sharp. His arms lengthened to legs, and his hands and feet became hooves. Terrified, he bounded, marveling that he should move so rapidly. But when he paused for breath and drink and beheld his features in a clear pool, he reared back aghast. A terrible fate then befell Actaeon. His own hounds, catching the scent of the great stag, came baying through the wood. In a moment of joy at hearing them, he paused, but then spontaneously took fright and fled. The pack followed, gradually gaining. When they had come to his heels, the first of them flying at his flank, he tried to cry their names. But the sound in his throat was not human. They fixed him with their fangs. He went down, and his own hunting companions, shouting encouragement at the dogs, arrived in time to deliver the coup de grace. Diana, miraculously aware of the flight and death, could now rest appeased. The mythological figure of the Universal Mother imputes to the cosmos the feminine attributes of the first nourishing and protecting presence. The fantasy is primarily spontaneous, for there exists a close and obvious correspondence between the attitude of the young child toward its mother and that of the adult toward the surrounding material world. But there has been also, in numerous religious traditions, a consciously controlled pedagogical utilization of this archetypal image for the purpose of the purging, balancing, and initiation of the mind into the nature of the visible world. In the tantric books of medieval and modern India, the abode of the goddess is called Mani Dvipa, the island of jewels. Her couch and throne is there, in a grove of wish-fulfilling trees. The beaches of the isle are of golden sands. They are laved by the still waters of the ocean of the nectar of immortality. The goddess is red with the fire of life. The earth, the solar system, the galaxies of far-extending space all swell within her womb. For she is the world creatrix, ever mother, ever virgin. She encompasses the encompassing, nourishes the nourishing, and is the life of everything that lives. She is also the death of everything that dies. The whole round of existence is accomplished within her sway, from birth through adolescence, maturity, and senescence to the grave. She is the womb and the tomb, the sow that eats her farrow. Thus she unites the good and the bad, exhibiting the two modes of the remembered mother, not as personal only, but as universal. The devotee is expected to contemplate the two with equal equanimity. Through this exercise, his spirit is purged of its infantile, inappropriate sentimentalities and resentments, and his mind opened to the inscrutable presence which exists not primarily as good and bad with respect to his childlike human convenience, his weal and woe, but as the law and image of the nature of being.
The sacred writings, shastras, of Hinduism are divided into four classes. 1. Shruti, which are regarded as direct divine revelation. These include the four Vedas, ancient books of Psalms, and certain of the Upanishads, ancient books of philosophy. 2. Smriti, which include the traditional teachings of the orthodox sages, canonical instructions for domestic ceremonials, and certain works of secular and religious law, as well as the great Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, which of course includes the Bhagavad Gita. 3. Purana, which are the Hindu mythological and epic works par excellence. These treat of cosmogonic, theological, astronomical, and physical knowledge. And 4. Tantra, texts describing techniques and rituals for the worship of deities, and for the attainment of supranormal power. Among the tantras are a group of particularly important scriptures, called Agamas, which are supposed to have been revealed directly by the universal god Shiva and his goddess, Parvati. They are termed, therefore, the fifth Veda. These support a mystical tradition known specifically as the Tantra, which has exercised a pervasive influence on the later forms of Hindu and Buddhist iconography. Tantric symbolism was carried by medieval Buddhism out of India into Tibet, China, and Japan.
The great Hindu mystic of the 19th century, Ramakrishna, 1836 to 1886, was a priest in a temple newly erected to the Cosmic Mother at Dakshineswar, a suburb of Calcutta. The temple image displayed the divinity in her two aspects simultaneously, the terrible and the benign. Her four arms exhibited the symbols of her universal power, the upper left hand brandishing a bloody saber, the lower gripping by the hair a severed human head. The upper right was lifted in the fear not gesture, the lower extended in bestowal of boons. As necklace, she wore a garland of human heads. Her kilt was a girdle of human arms. Her long tongue was out to lick blood. She was cosmic power, the totality of the universe, the harmonization of all the pairs of opposites, combining wonderfully the terror of absolute destruction with an impersonal yet motherly reassurance. As change, the river of time, the fluidity of life, the goddess at once creates, preserves, and destroys. Her name is Kali, the Black One. Her title, the Ferry Across the Ocean of Existence. One quiet afternoon, Ramakrishna beheld a beautiful woman ascend from the Ganges and approach the grove in which he was meditating. He perceived that she was about to give birth to a child. In a moment, the babe was born, and she gently nursed it. Presently, however, she assumed a horrible aspect, took the infant in her now ugly jaws and crushed it, chewed it. Swallowing it, she returned again to the Ganges, where she disappeared. Only geniuses capable of the highest realization can support the full revelation of the sublimity of this goddess. For lesser men, she reduces her effulgence and permits herself to appear in forms concordant with their undeveloped powers. Fully to behold her would be a terrible accident for any person not spiritually prepared, as witness the unlucky case of the lusty young buck, Actaeon. No saint was he, but a sportsman, unprepared for the revelation of the form that must be beheld without the normal human, i.e. infantile, over and undertones of desire, surprise, and fear. Woman, in the picture language of mythology, represents the totality of what can be known. The hero is the one who comes to know. As he progresses in the slow initiation which is life, the form of the goddess undergoes for him a series of transfigurations. She can never be greater than himself, though she can always promise more than he is yet capable of comprehending. She lures, she guides, she bids him burst his fetters. And if he can match her import, the two, the knower and the known, will be released from every limitation. Woman is the guide to the sublime acme of sensuous adventure. By deficient eyes, she is reduced to inferior states. By the evil eye of ignorance, she is spellbound to banality and ugliness. But she is redeemed by the eyes of understanding. The hero who can take her as she is, without undue commotion, but with the kindness and assurance she requires, is potentially the king, the incarnate god of her created world. A story, for example, is told of the five sons of the Irish king Eochaid, of how, having gone one day a-hunting, they found themselves astray, shut in on every hand. Thirsty, they set off, one by one, to look for water. Fergus was the first.
And he lights on a well, over which he finds an old woman standing sentry. The fashion of the hag is this: blacker than coal, every joint and segment of her was, from crown to ground, comparable to a wild horse's tail, the grey wiry mass of hair that pierced her scalp's upper surface. With her sickle of a greenish-looking tusk that was in her head, and curled till it touched her ear, she could lop the verdant branch of an oak in full bearing. Blackened and smoke-bleared eyes she had, nose awry, wide-nostrilled, a wrinkled and freckled belly, variously unwholesome, warped, crooked shins, garnished with massive ankles and a pair of capacious shovels. Knotty knees she had, and livid nails. The beldam's whole description, in fact, was disgusting. "That's the way it is it?" said the lad. "And that's the very way?" she answered. "Is it guarding the well thou art?" he asked. And she said, "It is. Dost thou license me to take away some water?" "I do," she consented, "yet only so that I have of thee one kiss on my cheek." "Not so," said he. "Then water shall not be conceded by me." "My word I give," he went on, "that sooner than give thee a kiss I would perish of thirst." Then the young man departed to the place where his brethren were, and told them that he had not gotten water.
Oliol, Brian, and Fiacre likewise went on the quest, and equally attained to the identical well. Each solicited the old thing for water, but denied her the kiss. Finally, it was Neil who went, and he came to the very well.
"Let me have water, woman!" he cried. "I will give it," said she, "and bestow on me a kiss." He answered, "For by giving thee a kiss, I will even hug thee." Then he bends to embrace her and gives her a kiss, which operation ended, and when he looked at her, in the whole world was not a young woman of gait more graceful, in universal semblance fairer than she. To be likened to the last fallen snow lying in trenches, every portion of her was, from crown to sole. Plump and queenly forearms, fingers long and taper, straight legs of a lovely hue she had. Two sandals of the white bronze betwixt her smooth and soft white feet and the earth. About her was an ample mantle of the choicest fleece, pure crimson, and in the garment a brooch of white silver. She had lustrous teeth of pearl, great regal eyes, mouth red as the rowan berry. "Here, woman, is a galaxy of charms," said the young man. "That is true indeed." "And who art thou?" he pursued. "Royal rule, am I," she answered, and uttered this. "King of Tara, I am royal rule." "Go now," she said, "to thy brethren, and take with thee water. Moreover, thine and thy children's, for ever the kingdom and supreme power shall be. And as at the first thou hast seen me ugly, brutish, loathly, in the end beautiful, even so is royal rule. For without battles, without fierce conflict, it may not be won. But in the result, he that is king of no matter what shows comely and handsome forth."
Such is royal rule. Such is life itself. The goddess guardian of the inexhaustible well, whether as Fergus or as Actaeon, or as the prince of the lonesome isle discovered her, requires that the hero should be endowed with what the troubadours and minnesingers termed the gentle heart. Not by the animal desire of an Actaeon, not by the fastidious revulsion of such as Fergus, can she be comprehended and rightly served, but only by gentleness, aware, gentle sympathy. It was named in the romantic courtly poetry of 10th to 12th century Japan.
Within the gentle heart, love shelters himself, as birds within the green shade of the grove. Before the gentle heart in nature's scheme, love was not, nor the gentle heart ere love. For with the sun at once, so sprang the light immediately, nor was its birth before the sun's, And love hath his effect in gentleness of very self, even as within the middle fire the heat's excess.
The meeting with the goddess, who is incarnate in every woman, is the final test of the talent of the hero to win the boon of love. Charity, amor fati, which is life itself enjoyed as the encasement of eternity. And when the adventurer in this context is not a youth but a maid, she is the one who, by her qualities, her beauty, or her yearning, is fit to become the consort of an immortal. Then the heavenly husband descends to her and conducts her to his bed, whether she will or no. And if she has shunned him, the scales fall from her eyes. If she has sought him, her desire finds its peace. The Arapaho girl who followed the porcupine up the stretching tree was enticed to the camp circle of the people of the sky. There she became the wife of a heavenly youth. It was he who, under the form of the luring porcupine, had seduced her to his supernatural home. The king's daughter of the nursery tale, the day following the adventure at the well, heard a thumping at her castle door. The frog had arrived to press her to her bargain. And in spite of her great disgust, he followed her to her chair at table, shared the meal from her little golden plate and cup, even insisted on going to sleep with her in her little silken bed. In a tantrum, she plucked him from the floor and flung him at the wall. When he fell, he was no frog, but a king's son with kind and beautiful eyes. And then we hear that they were married and were driven in a beautiful coach back to the young man's waiting kingdom, where the two became a king and queen. Or once again, when Psyche had accomplished all of the difficult tasks, Jupiter himself gave to her a draught of the elixir of immortality, so that she is now and forever united with Cupid, her beloved, in the paradise of perfected form. The Greek Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches celebrate the same mystery in the Feast of the Assumption. The Virgin Mary is taken up into the bridal chamber of heaven, where the King of Kings sits on his starry throne. O Virgin most prudent, whither goest thou, bright as the morn? All beautiful and sweet art thou, O daughter of Zion, fair as the moon, elect as the sun. 3. Woman as the Temptress. The mystical marriage with the queen goddess of the world represents the hero's total mastery of life. For the woman is life, the hero its knower and master. And the testings of the hero, which were preliminary to his ultimate experience and deed, were symbolical of those crises of realization by means of which his consciousness came to be amplified and made capable of enduring the full possession of the Mother Destroyer, his inevitable bride. With that he knows that he and the Father are one. He is in the Father's place. Thus phrased, in extremist terms, the problem may sound remote from the affairs of normal human creatures. Nevertheless, every failure to cope with a life situation must be laid, in the end, to a restriction of consciousness. Wars and temper tantrums are the makeshifts of ignorance. Regrets are illuminations come too late. The whole sense of the ubiquitous myth of the hero's passage is that it shall serve as a general pattern for men and women, wherever they may stand along the scale. Therefore, it is formulated in the broadest terms. The individual has only to discover his own position with reference to this general human formula, and let it then assist him past his restricting walls. Who and where are his ogres? Those are the reflections of the unsolved enigmas of his own humanity. What are his ideals? Those are the symptoms of his grasp of life. In the office of the modern psychoanalyst, the stages of the hero adventure come to light again in the dreams and hallucinations of the patient. Depth beyond depth of self-ignorance is fathomed, with the analyst in the role of the helper, the initiatory priest. And always, after the first thrills of getting underway, the adventure develops into a journey of darkness, horror, disgust, and phantasmagoric fears. The crux of the curious difficulty lies in the fact that our conscious views of what life ought to be seldom correspond to what life really is. Generally, we refuse to admit within ourselves or within our friends the fullness of that pushing, self-protective, malodorous, carnivorous, lecherous fever, which is the very nature of the organic cell. Rather, we tend to perfume, whitewash, and reinterpret, meanwhile imagining that all the flies in the ointment, all the hairs in the soup, are the faults of some unpleasant someone else. But when it suddenly dawns on us, or is forced to our attention, that everything we think or do is necessarily tainted with the odor of the flesh, then, not uncommonly, there is experienced a moment of revulsion. Life, the acts of life, the organs of life, woman in particular as the great symbol of life, become intolerable to the pure, pure soul.
Oh, that this too, too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. Oh, that the everlasting had not fixed his cannon against self-slaughter. Oh, God! God!
So exclaims the great spokesman of this moment, Hamlet.
How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fiant, ah, fie, 'tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely, that it should come to this.
The innocent delight of Oedipus in his first possession of the queen turns to an agony of spirit when he learns who the woman is. Like Hamlet, he is beset by the moral image of the father. Like Hamlet, he turns from the fair features of the world to search the darkness for a higher kingdom than this, of the incest and adultery-ridden, luxurious and incorrigible mother. The seeker of the life beyond life must press beyond her, surpass the temptations of her call, and soar to the immaculate ether beyond.
For a god called him many times, from many sides at once. Ho, Oedipus, thou Oedipus, why are we tarrying? It is full long that thou art stayed for. Come!
Where this Oedipus-Hamlet revulsion remains to beset the soul, there the world, the body, and woman above all, become the symbols no longer of victory, but of defeat. A monastic, puritanical, world-negating ethical system, then radically and immediately transfigures all the images of myth. No longer can the hero rest in innocence with the goddess of the flesh, for she has become the queen of sin. The Hindu monk Shankaracharya writes,
"So long as a man has any regard for this corpse-like body, he is impure, and suffers from his enemies as well as from birth, disease, and death. But when he thinks of himself as pure, as the essence of the good and the immovable, he becomes free. Throw far away this limitation of a body which is inert and filthy by nature. Think of it no longer, for a thing that has been vomited, as you should vomit forth your body, can excite only disgust when it is recalled again to mind."
This is a point of view familiar to the West from the lives and writings of the saints.
When St. Peter observed that his daughter, Petronilla, was too beautiful, he obtained from God the favor that she should fall sick of a fever. Now, one day when his disciples were by him, Titus said to him, "You who cure all maladies,
Why do you not fix it so that Petronilla can get up from her bed? And Peter replied to him, Because I am satisfied with her condition as it is. This was by no means as much as to say he had not the power to cure her, for immediately he said to her, Get up, Petronilla, and make haste to wait on us. The young girl, cured, got up and came to serve them. But when she had finished, her father said to her, Petronilla, return to your bed. She returned, and was straightway taken again with the fever. And later, when she had begun to be perfect in her love of God, her father restored her to perfect health. At that time, a noble gentleman named Flaccus, struck by her beauty, came to bid for her hand in marriage. She replied, If you wish to marry me, send a group of young girls to conduct me to your home. But when these had arrived, Petronilla directly set herself to fast and pray. Receiving communion, she lay back in her bed, and after 3 days rendered her soul up to God. As a child, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux suffered from headaches. A young woman came to visit him one day, to soothe his sufferings with her songs. But the indignant child drove her from the room, and God rewarded him for his zeal, for he got up from his bed immediately and was cured. Now the ancient enemy of man, perceiving little Bernard to be of such wholesome disposition, exerted himself to set traps for his chastity. When the child, however, at the instigation of the devil, one day had stood staring at a lady for some time, suddenly he blushed for himself, and entered the icy water of a pond in penance, where he remained until frozen to his bones. Another time, when he was asleep, a young girl came naked to his bed. Bernard, becoming aware of her, yielded in silence the part of the bed in which he lay, and rolling over to the other side, returned to sleep. Having stroked and caressed him for some time, the unhappy creature presently was so taken with shame, in spite of her shamelessness, that she got up and fled, full of horror at herself and of admiration for the young man. Still again, when Bernard, together with some friends, one time had accepted the hospitality of the home of a certain wealthy lady, she, observing his beauty, was seized with a passion to sleep with him. She arose that night from her bed, and came and placed herself at the side of her guest. But he, the minute he felt someone close to him, began to shout, Thief! Thief! Immediately thereupon, the woman scurried away, the entire house was on its feet, lanterns were lit, and everybody hunted around for the burglar. But since none was found, all returned to their beds and to sleep, with the sole exception of this lady, who, unable to close her eyes, again arose and slipped into the bed of her guest. Bernard began to shout, Thief! And again the alarms and investigations. After that, even a third time this lady brought herself to be spurned in like fashion, so that finally she gave up her wicked project, out of either fear or discouragement. On the road next day the companions of Bernard asked him why he had had so many dreams about thieves, and he replied to them, I had really to repel the attacks of a thief. For my hostess tried to rob me of a treasure which, had I lost it, I should never have been able to regain. All of which convinced Bernard that it was a pretty risky thing to live together with the serpent. So he planned to be quit of the world and enter the monastic order of the Cistercians.
Not even monastery walls, however, not even the remoteness of the desert, can defend against the female presences. For as long as the hermit's flesh clings to his bones and pulses warm, the images of life are alert to storm his mind. Saint Anthony, practicing his austerity in the Egyptian Thebaid, was troubled by voluptuous hallucinations perpetrated by female devils attracted to his magnetic solitude. Apparitions of this order, with loins of irresistible attraction and breasts bursting to be touched, are known to all the hermit resorts of history. This succubus is the spirit of the Queen of Sheba. Ah, belle ermite, si tu posais ton doigt sur mon épaule, se serait comme une traînée de feu dans tes veines. La possession de la moindre place de mon corps t'emplira d'une joie plus véhémente que la conquête d'un empire. Avance tes lèvres. Ah, beautiful hermitess, if you set your finger against my flesh, it would be as a strand of fire through thy veins. The possession of the least part of my body should fill thee with a joy more vehement than an empire's conquest. Bring on thy lips. Writes the New Englander Cotton Mather,
the wilderness through which we are passing to the Promised Land is all filled with fiery flying serpents. But, blessed be God, none of them have hitherto so fastened upon us as to confound us utterly. All our way to heaven lies by dens of lions and the mounts of leopards. There are incredible droves of devils in our way. We are poor travellers in a world which is as well the devil's field as the devil's jail, a world in which every nook whereof the devil is encamped with bands of robbers to pastor all that have their faces looking Zionward.
4. Atonement with the Father.
The bow of God's wrath is bent, and the arrow made ready on the string. And justice bends the arrow at your heart and strains the bow. And it is nothing but the mere pleasure of God, and that of an angry God, without any promise or obligation at all, that keeps the arrow one moment from being made drunk with your blood.
With these words, Jonathan Edwards threatened the hearts of his New England congregation by disclosing to them, unmitigated, the ogre aspect of the Father. He riveted them to the pews with images of the mythological ordeal. For though the Puritan prohibited the graven image, yet he allowed himself the verbal. The wrath, Jonathan Edwards thundered.
The wrath of God is like great waters that are dammed for the present. They increase more and more, and rise higher and higher, till an outlet is given. And the longer the stream is stopped, the more rapid and mighty is its course when once it is let loose. 'Tis true, the judgment against your evil works has not been executed hitherto. The floods of God's vengeance have been withheld. But your guilt, in the meantime, is constantly increasing, and you are every day treasuring up more wrath. The waters are continually rising, and waxing more and more mighty, and there is nothing but the mere pleasure of God that holds the waters back, that are unwilling to be stopped, and press hard to go forward. If God should only withdraw his hand from the floodgate, it would immediately fly open, and the fiery floods of the fierceness of the wrath of God would rush forth with inconceivable fury, and would come upon you with omnipotent power, and if your strength were 10,000 times greater than it is, yea, 10,000 times greater than the strength of the stoutest, sturdiest devil in hell, it would be nothing to withstand or endure it.
Having threatened with the element water, Pastor Jonathan next turns to the image of fire.
The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you, and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful, venomous serpent is in ours. You have offended him infinitely more than ever a stubborn rebel did his prince, and yet 'tis nothing but his hand that holds you from falling into the fire every moment. Oh, sinner, you hang by a slender thread,
with the flames of divine wrath flashing about it, and ready every moment to singe it and burn it asunder. And you have no interest in any mediator, and nothing to lay hold of to save yourself, nothing to keep off the flames of wrath, nothing of your own, nothing that you ever have done, nothing that you can do to induce God to spare you one moment.
But now, at last, the great resolving image of the second birth. Only for a moment, however.
Thus are all you that never passed under a great change of heart, by the mighty power of the Spirit of God upon your souls. All that were never born again, and made new creatures, and raised from being dead in sin, to a state of new, and before altogether unexperienced light and life, however you may have reformed your life in many things, and may have had religious affections, and may keep up a form of religion in your families and closets, and in the house of God, and may be strict in it. You are thus in the hands of an angry God. 'Tis nothing but his mere pleasure that keeps you from being this moment swallowed up in everlasting destruction.
God's mere pleasure, which defends the sinner from the arrow, the flood and the flames, is termed in the traditional vocabulary of Christianity God's mercy, and the mighty power of the Spirit of God, by which the heart is changed, that is God's grace. In most mythologies, the images of mercy and grace are rendered as vividly as those of justice and wrath, so that a balance is maintained and the heart is buoyed rather than scourged along its way. Fear not, says the hand gesture of the god Shiva, as he dances before his devotee, the dance of the universal destruction. Fear not, for all rests well in God. The forms that come and go, and of which your body is but one, are the flashes of my dancing limbs. Know me in all, and of what shall you be afraid? The magic of the sacraments, made effective through the passion of Jesus Christ, or by virtue of the meditations of the Buddha, the protective power of primitive amulets and charms, and the supernatural helpers of the myths and fairy tales of the world, are mankind's assurances that the arrow, the flames, and the flood are not as brutal as they seem. For the ogre aspect of the father is a reflex of the victim's own ego, derived from the sensational nursery scene that has been left behind, but projected before. And the fixating idolatry of that pedagogical non-thing is itself the fault that keeps one steeped in a sense of sin, sealing the potentially adult spirit from a better balanced, more realistic view of the father, and therewith of the world. Atonement, at one meant, consists in no more than the abandonment of that self-generated double monster. The dragon, thought to be God, superego, or interego, and the dragon thought to be sin, repressed id. But this requires an abandonment of the attachment to ego itself, and that is what is difficult. One must have a faith that the Father is merciful, and then a reliance on that mercy. Therewith, the center of belief is transferred outside of the bedeviling God's tight, scaly ring, and the dreadful ogres dissolve. It is in this ordeal that the hero may derive hope and assurance from the helpful female figure, by whose magic, pollen charms, or power of intercession, he is protected through all the frightening experiences of the father's ego-shattering initiation. For if it is impossible to trust the terrifying father face, then one's faith must be centered elsewhere, Spider Woman, Blessed Mother, and with that reliance for support, one endures the crisis, only to find, in the end, that the father and mother reflect each other and are, in essence, the same. When the twin warriors of the Navajo, having departed from Spider Woman with her advice and protective charms, had made their perilous way between the rocks that crush, through the reeds that cut to pieces, and the cactus plants that tear to pieces, and then across the boiling sands, they came at last to the house of the sun, their father. The door was guarded by two bears. These arose and growled, but the words that Spider-Woman had taught the boys made the animals crouch down again. After the bears, there threatened a pair of serpents, then winds, then lightnings, the guardians of the ultimate threshold. All were readily appeased, however, with the words of the prayer. Built of turquoise, the house of the sun was great and square, and it stood on the shore of a mighty water. The boys entered it, and they beheld a woman sitting in the west, two handsome young men in the south, two handsome young women in the north. The young women stood up without a word, wrapped the newcomers in four sky coverings, and placed them on a shelf. The boys lay quietly. Presently, a rattle hanging over the door shook four times, and one of the young women said, "Our father is coming." The bearer of the sun strode into his home, removed the sun from his back, and hung it on a peg on the west wall of the room, where it shook and clanged for some time, going, "Kla, kla, kla, kla." He turned to the older woman and demanded angrily, "Who were those two that entered here today?" But the woman did not reply. The young people looked at one another. The bearer of the sun put his question angrily four times before the woman said to him at last, "It would be well for you not to say too much. Two young men came hither today seeking their father. You have told me that you pay no visits when you go abroad, and that you have met no woman but me. Whose sons, then, are these?" She pointed to the bundle on the shelf, and the children smiled significantly at one another. The bearer of the sun took the bundle from the shelf, unrolled the four robes, the robes of dawn, blue sky, yellow evening light, and darkness, and the boys fell out on the floor. He immediately seized them. Fiercely, he flung them at some great sharp spikes of white shell that stood in the east. The boys tightly clutched their life feathers and bounded back. The man hurled them equally at spikes of turquoise in the south, haliotis in the west, and black rock in the north. The boys always clutched their life feathers tightly and came bounding back. "I wish it were indeed true," said the sun, "that they were my children."
Four symbolical colors, representing the points of the compass, play a prominent role in Navajo iconography and cult. They are white, blue, yellow, and black, signifying respectively east, south, west, and north. These correspond to the red, white, green, and black on the hat of the African trickster divinity Edshu, for the house of the father, like the father himself, symbolizes the center. The twin heroes are tested against the symbols of the four directions to discover whether they partake of the faults and limitations of any one of the quarters.
The terrible father essayed, then, to steam the boys to death in an overheated sweat lodge. They were aided by the winds, who provided a protected retreat within the lodge in which to hide. "Yes, these are my children," said the son when they emerged, but that was only a ruse, for he was still planning to trick them. The final ordeal was a smoking pipe filled with poison. A spiny caterpillar warned the boys and gave them something to put into their mouths. They smoked the pipe without harm, passing it back and forth to one another, till it was finished. They even said it tasted sweet. The son was proud. He was completely satisfied. "Now, my children," he asked, "what is it you want from me? Why do you seek me? The twin heroes had won the full confidence of the son, their father. The need for great care on the part of the father, admitting to his house only those who have been thoroughly tested, is illustrated by the unhappy